Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be doing our top 10 egg stories of 2025. We'll count them all down. With me today is Bill Schomburg.
Hey guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. How did you guys ring in the new year? Well, Todd, I know how you did because we were at the same party. But yeah.
We had the TV on and we went to bed early.
Woo! Yeah. Woo! Party animal. Don't stop me now. Having such a good time. Did you at least pop some bubbly or something before you went to bed? No?
Nope. We watched Ryan Seacrest for a little while. Which just is now, let's go to all the different cities and have concerts.
That's what it's turned into? Okay.
Definitely what it seemed like. So at the party we were at, there were kids and adults, and the kids were watching some of that, and it just seemed like, just concert after concert.
Just in different time zones to, like...
Yep, Chicago, Las Vegas, New York.
So Vegas is the... Okay, yeah, so one in each time zone, so they can... Was it Nashville always one? Did they get rid of that?
Yeah, that was one.
I would think Nashville's got to be a big party.
Right.
So there's probably stuff going in there, yeah. But that's central time zone like Chicago.
Right. I think that used to be the central. That's why I thought it was interesting of Chicago now.
I don't know. Can't tell you how they pick the
Ryan Seacrest just goes to each city and...
Yep.
Do they still say Dick Clark's Rockin' Eve or did they find
I don't even know. I... Wasn't paying close enough attention.
They finally buried Dick Clark.
Well, kind of. Felt like he, Seacrest was definitely taking over. And
it was for a long time. They kept calling it Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve. Of course, Dick Clark was still alive for a chunk of it after Seacrest took over. But
the best was watching Diana Ross sing Mo Money, Mo Problems.
What?
Yeah.
I'm not even sure how I feel about that. That seems like an interesting take.
Yep. Then we went to bed. That was enough.
They still do call it Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve with Ryan Seacrest. So,
sure. I mean,
they just kind of
like should be that way, right? Like he kind of started it.
Yeah, Dick Clark was a big deal for a long time. And was it the stroke? Is that why he stopped hosting, or did he quit before that? Because I remember him being on there like after he had the stroke, and
shouldn't have been.
Well, no, it was just like I think they brought him in. Seacrest was hosting it at the time.
Oh, he just came in for a cameo.
He just like came in, and his speech was real garbled and everything, but.
So did all the kids make it to midnight at the party?
Yeah.
Actually?
There were two that took a nap between the... And it was like two of the oldest kids, too, which is made it even funnier. The one had just had their wisdom teeth out, so
ooh.
Understandable.
Yeah. Yep. Then when does everybody pack up? Like
12 drops?
No, well, like before midnight, I feel like everybody's kind of... Packed up by 11:30 so that...
Well, our one friends were going to go home and watch Stranger Things because yesterday was the last episode. It was like a big two-hour finale.
Okay.
And our one friend was worried about spoilers, so we were joking with him, like, yep, just get everything in the car now. And then, midnight, out the door, you're in the car, you're home by like 12:30 and you can watch
So they released it right at midnight?
No, we actually released it like 7, I think.
7 on New Year's Eve.
On New Year's Eve, yep.
Interesting. Okay.
So you could not watch it before 7 o'clock.
Well, they should have watched it before they came.
The party started at 6.
Oh. That's a long party.
Yeah, 6 hours. 6 and a half, somewhere in there. I didn't get there till I think we got there a little after 7. Surprisingly, Todd was there before me.
Yeah, so. I beat him there, so.
That is a deal.
That does not.
Is that a New Year's resolution, Todd?
No.
Todd, time is changing.
Based on the...
This morning,
I don't think so.
I've had past New Year's resolutions for that, and it's not. It's already done.
It's ingrained.
It's just.
But yeah, no, played some games. They had these, you know, the poppers where you like pull the string, but they're shaped like a gun now, and there's a trigger.
Really?
And the trigger, yeah, we like disassembled them to see the mechanism. And it still is the.
So the trigger pulls the string.
Yeah. Yes, basically pulls the string, but they were.
That's kind of cool.
They were cool.
Yeah. I think only the host got shot in the butt with one, so.
He deserved it.
Everybody else managed not to get hit in the face or eyes or anything important. So. All right. Well, even though it is 2026, we're going to run down the top 10 ag stories of 2025. So you guys ready to do this?
Yep.
All right. So coming in, number 10. Last year we talked about, in episode 281, NASA's new satellites that could change the way we farm forever. That is the NISAR satellite. And it was launched, I think it was launched this year. It was at the time of the article, it was pending launch. So I'm assuming it happened. I guess I didn't do my due diligence and look it up. But these satellites are hopefully going to allow for greater viewing of farm fields and what is going on in those fields. And they'll be the first radar satellites that employ the L and S bands, which give a broader range of surface features. So
yeah, they launched July 30th of 2025. So
there you go.
They're up there. Hopefully they can start doing the mission and sending pictures back to us.
So maybe this year we'll get to see some sweet data. You never know. All right, from there we'll roll into number 9, which is a new tool for Wisconsin cover crop data. We've talked about it in episode 294. So this new tool is a look at some different insights for how to use cover crops for, depending on what you want, whether it's erosion control, nutrient scavenging, nitrogen crediting, weed suppression, fall grazing, spring grazing, all those things. And it is a kind of just a database of way to look at some of the different cover crops that have been done in the past. It's a collaborative effort between Michael Fields Institute, UW-Madison Extension Nutrient and Pest Management Program, Nature Conservancy, USDA Forage Research Center, and UW-Madison College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. So since 2020, they've collected data from over 220 fields across Wisconsin, giving them a pretty good breadth of data there.
It's pretty neat. You just, it's like drop downs. You just go to their tool and drop down what you want to look at, whether it's erosion control, weed suppression, fall grazing, click in your soil type in your county, and bam, it's right there. It gives you some options.
All right. Coming in at number 8, soybean cyst nematode continues to spread. This is a discussion we had in episode 273. So SCN is found in every soybean-producing state except one. So 31 counties in 10 U.S. states, 10 rural municipalities in Quebec, and 3 counties in Manitoba and Ontario reported the pest for the first time from 2020 through 2023. So it's a look at basically the central and eastern seaboard of central part of the U.S. and the eastern seaboard, pretty much red with where soybean cyst nematode can be found. And yeah, it's a constant pest we're working with. We know that from past discussions in this podcast and in meetings and whatnot, that we are on the hunt for better options for SCN, as the two types of resistance that are out there, one is starting to break down. So we need some new options. So it continues to be an issue facing lots of soybean farmers out there.
This one for 2026, I feel like, is my resolution.
It's your resolution. More?
Just try to...
you do enough as it is, Todd.
Yeah, we did a bunch of tests again this year. And
did you do 100?
No, not that many.
Not that many? 50.
But it was a fair amount, and they came back confirming what we expected. It was where we thought it was and wasn't necessarily where we kind of didn't think it was. So
they were who you thought they were?
Yes. It's not necessarily spreading... A tremendous amount within, you know, we already have it in spots, and it's right. not necessarily getting worse, but it is crazy how many of these are into Canada now and just spreading all over.
The mountains of West Virginia must just
block, keep
them away.
Yep.
None in West Virginia.
They're not very good mountain climbers. They haven't learned to yodel yet.
It's crazy looking at Illinois and Iowa, like every county is red on the map.
Yeah.
Indiana, there's only two counties that aren't, but
that's got to be a
just got to go grow some soybeans in the UP there.
Really, yeah, the UP is free
of soybean cyst nematode.
Well, there is some soybeans up there.
There are, yeah. All right, coming in at number 7, you weren't crazy. We weren't crazy. It was the windiest spring in 50 years. This past spring, so we started out the 2025 growing season with a fair amount of wind. This was something we talked about in episode 290. So the high winds posed plenty of problems, including timely spraying being a major issue for a lot of farms, because obviously you don't want your spray to go off your farm onto someone else's farm. So a limited number of options and days for applications this past spring. So
yeah, need a little wind here.
No,
is right. Yes, we did not need any more wind.
That was a discussion of like I've had with just non-farm people too this spring. Like they just would ask, like, why is it so windy? It's kind of glad we came across this because
you kind of forget
good
about
conversation.
I forget how windy it was, and it was frustratingly windy.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's a good thing when you need to dry out some fields. You want the wind, but it's not a good thing once you've actually got them planted and you need to spray. So
it wasn't necessarily that it was like, it was just always windy. It wasn't like,
yeah, no, it was like,
like we were getting these excessively high gusts. You did have that, but it just,
every 3 to 4 days we'd have like a decent day, maybe.
Right.
And those are usually the days when it rains or just something else that keeps you out of the field. So your odds were not very good this past spring. So hopefully we won't see that trend continue into spring of 2026. Speaking of 6, we're up to that in our countdown, number 6. And that is some Maryland scientists found a gene that could triple wheat yield. So wheat is a crop that we grow here in Wisconsin. It's not one of our biggest cash crops, but it is a nice rotational crop to work in if you have the option to do so or if you need the straw. And these University of Maryland researchers found a way to potentially develop the grain of the wheat and add a couple extra ovaries to the plant. So the special trait of growing 3 ovaries per flower was initially discovered spontaneously, occurring in a mutant of common bred wheat, and they are trying to sort that out so that they could breed it into future varieties and just cram that head with kernels.
This is like a fan favorite of mine.
Oh, yeah.
The pictures are awesome. Yeah, Google up the pictures of the wheat heads. Just look, they look like something's wrong, actually. They don't look like
spray damage.
Right, like. Yeah, yep. Some sort of plant growth regulator got a hold of this wheat head. But yes, like Matt said, it's putting 3 kernels.
You know there's a corn breeder somewhere trying to do this, right?
Yeah, I mean,
oh, yeah.
They're both grasses, so.
Trying to shove a bunch of
try to and pull that over. And
What would a corn cob look like, Todd, if it looked like wheat?
It looked mutant.
So we're going to have, 3-foot tall corn plants with 3 cobs on them. That would be a pain in the butt. to try. We have to come up with some new harvest equipment, I think, or at least some modifications to existing harvest equipment. All right, coming in at number 5 in our countdown, we've got BMR making strides over the last 90 years, but unfortunately it is going bye-bye. So this was episode 311 and episode 281. We discussed the impending loss of BMR, at least from the Corteva family of genetics. And yeah, BMR had come a long way in the last 90 years over the time since it was first found as a naturally occurring gene mutation in dent corn in 1924. But yeah, the lower lignin and increased digestibility made it a favorite of some dairy farmers.
There must be some heavy hitters coming because this one would be this top 3 for me.
This one didn't go higher because there's going to be some farmers just don't even.
Not everybody.
Let's be real. Most farmers aren't even going to notice it, and they're not going to feel bad for you either. That's the bad part.
Right.
I agree, Bill. This to me was kind of a real heavy hitter that I can still remember when the news came because I felt it came a bit odd because it came in like a press release. I don't know how else they would release the news either.
And it was this time of year.
It was March.
Between seasons, yeah.
It was March 13th, so, and Corteva kind of announced it. And the way it read, it was an update on Corteva BMR. Well, when it says update on this press release.
You think something new.
Yeah, you're like, oh, this is going to be great.
Yeah.
And then it was like,
wah, wah.
Wait, what? What are we doing?
And it's kind of escalated since March,
Right.
Escalation in the bad way of going away faster.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because they decided in the first headline is, we are phasing out BMR hybrid products in North America across our seed brands as we increase focus on corn silage options that are both high quality and high tonnage. So that, too, it read a little they told us, but it just, I think we weren't ready for the news, especially.
Later this year, we found out it's probably going to go faster than they initially intended.
So. Yeah. And they were coming out, there was new, we had just heard right before that, the fall before, there's all these new hybrids coming, new BMRs. So it was not expected that way either because of what we thought was coming. So
fast-paced world of corn genetics. New ones coming out, and it's going away.
And I was hoping we'd hear the news, Corteva sold the BMR, or there was a just some other sort of news.
We kind of knew when Brevant and Pioneer's BMRs were in the same parent company that something was going to happen.
Right.
I don't think we really fully understood that they were just going to kick them both to the curb.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seemed more like it would be a consolidation into one.
Yep.
Right.
This is it.
Yeah.
That's all you get.
You're not getting all these options of BMR. It's just this. The more you read into this, too, the traits that come along with this are making selling corn genetics harder because you have that part with it, and now you got to buy both the genetics and license the traits.
That's the thing the average person doesn't understand.
No, I didn't.
It's a huge driver.
That. Right.
It's probably the biggest of all.
Right.
Yeah.
There is still BMR corns out there. There's some.
Yep.
There is some sold as conventional hybrids, so they're not gone. It's just that type of the Corteva
brand. Right, that particular family of genetics will be unavailable.
Sayonara.
All right. Cutting into number 4 then. If you haven't heard of it, maybe you will hear of it again soon. The New World Screwworm is making its way back into America, and so the U.S. government has put up forward $750 million in a Texas fly facility to help eradicate the New World screwworm for good. So looking at building that facility to produce 300 million sterile flies per week and introducing those populations to then essentially force the screwworm to not be able to procreate, and that will help eliminate technology that's been used before. Most notably a few years ago in Florida to get rid of mosquitoes. They would release sterile populations to cut down on the disease-carrying little pests. So another way of using the same tactic to get rid of a pesky fly, that something we haven't had to deal with for a while, but is making its way back into our country. So hopefully things will go well with that and keep that particular pest at bay. Coming in at number three, tariffs have caused some soybean price struggles. So back in episode 282, we were having a discussion about some of the tariff issues that were going on and what that means for ag producers. Agriculture trade deficit was forecasted to widen in 2025. And so as part of that, tariffs were expected to maybe have an impact on that. And China did not buy much for U.S. soybeans till quite late in the year. They promised 12 million metric tons of U.S. soybean purchases, and that has not been completed by the end of the year as we are sitting here in the beginning of 2026. So depending on how you look at it, some people thought it was the end of the calendar year. Others are saying, well, it's the end of the fiscal year, which the government fiscal year starts in September. So I guess that would give them time to kind of finish that. But it's a complicated issue, and it's not going to get any less complicated as we move forward. Just something to keep an eye on, and that will definitely affect prices and everything moving forward.
Yeah, it was just a tough year for farmers that way, being caught in the crosshairs, if you will, on this trade issue. And whenever our biggest importer of our soy, you know, who we export the most to, kind of gets caught in this, and yeah, the farmers, unfortunately, we saw that, and we saw that in a lot of different things. Probably the biggest one, like we talked here, is the soybean price, but there's implications with fertilizers and other inputs that made this harder too. So a lot of things we import, then being other fertilizers or seed or whatever, will be, you know, a lot of those were higher too. So it's not only the depressed prices that are hurting us, it's also the just the higher input costs as well. So yep, just one of those things to keep managing through, keep, you know, making sure we're putting a pencil to everything to make sure hopefully we can be in the black as much as we can try to be. And then, yeah, hopefully this does get resolved, and as we look forward to 2026.
All right, coming in at number two then is the tight tassel wrap. No, not the little Easter egg song that was at the end of one of our episodes, but the
top 10 hit.
Yeah.
The actual effect that it has on a corn plant. So we talked about this in episodes 299 and 300. So tight tassel wrap is when the tassel can't quite get free of that last leaf, and so it affects pollination and can cause some issues on the kernels of plants around it. So obviously we always want good population. We want good population too. Good pollination. And this was a detriment to that. Saw it to a certain extent. I don't think it was as big of a deal for us here in Wisconsin as maybe in some other places. It certainly was out there. We were able to see that in the field, but didn't have the same impact as maybe there was concern that it would have. So
we definitely didn't have the affected ears like other, no. You know, obviously if it pollinated and that was enough pollen out there to kind of in general pollinate everything, even that had this tight tassel wrap, it seemed like we talked about this in multiple episodes, and luckily it really turned out to not be an issue, which is great. And maybe it will be in the future again. We got to watch for it. But the other hard part with this one was there wasn't really, we could have done anything about it anyway. It was like,
no, at the time we were like, what's this going to do? It doesn't look very good. But in the end,
pay your kids to go out and
yes,
unwrap the tassel.
And it did seem like we talked about that in the episodes. It was more of like a delayed emergence of Tassel. Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily that it was some of the ours were so wrapped tight that they couldn't get out. It was like it was just this really, I believe you called it shy Tassel, Matt.
Yes, it was. He didn't want to peek out. Just was like, ooh, don't look at me.
Sorry, Matt. There was some level of the fullness of the Tassel wasn't there either.
Yes, some of these are not, they're just not as.
Yeah, and we noticed the plots that it was, seemed to be somewhat varietal.
It was very varietal, yeah, yes.
And not like widespread among a bunch of varieties, which probably helped. I mean, as long as you keep some diversity on the farm, you probably wouldn't have had a major impact. Now, if you were planted all of one variety that had that particular issue this year, then you might be yelling at your listening device right now, like, shut up, you guys are wrong. But, all right, you guys ready?
Ready.
Can we get a drum roll for number one? Oh, do we actually
have a real one?
Sound?
It's more of a drum beat.
Yep, definitely not a drum roll. All right, so number one. One of the biggest topics we've talked about over and over again this year, in particular, we handled it in episodes 303 and 317, and that is southern rust. So, again, this one for our area, maybe not as big of a deal as other places. Iowa, in particular, got hammered by southern rust. But we did see it in a lot of the state to some extent, and you know, it's one that we don't deal with every year, so that's what makes it a little bit more unique and more of a notable story is it has to blow in. It's not something that carries over in general in our climate because of, you know, this wonderful thing we're experiencing right now called winter. But, yeah, it was definitely a hot topic this past year.
It was neat to see UW, I don't know if it was a crop update meeting. They had a talk on this, and it was a weatherman talking about how, like, I think it was, what did he say, mid-late June, there was this, like, nationwide front that came through, and it kind of opened up in the middle.
Really?
And that's kind of what, like, led to the Midwest getting southern rust was just the way the winds were, and then this storm kind of split, enabling the spores to kind of circle back through, and that's why we got it. And he's like, this isn't normal.
Sure.
Like, don't expect this again.
This to happen. That's very interesting news because we were saying how hot July, and you know, we also then had the weather to just make it explode.
Correct.
But having that linchpin annoying, okay, this is how it got here, and if we have a similar front to that to maybe watch it, but otherwise you're probably...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we could see it next year, but chances are probably not. Mm-hmm. Just because we haven't, I think... Maybe 2018 before last year was the last time. I can't remember the exact year, but it had been a while. And even that in that year, it wasn't a really bad outbreak. It was just that we saw it. So,
yeah. In general, this has been every 20 year thing.
Yeah.
Not sooner than that. And when something shows up every 20 years, you kind of forget about it. You just don't even think about it or worry about it. This was definitely varietal as well. Certain varieties. Seemed to get hurt worse. Certain varieties, I swear, also didn't. They more quickly showed the disease and then seemed to kind of hold it at bay a little bit after that. Like, they just got it quicker.
Yeah.
They got it quicker and then kind of held where other ones got it slower, but then they had the same severity of problems in the end of the season. This one, too, like you said, for us, Matt, ended up. There was a lot of panic set in.
Oh, yeah, there were a lot of fungicide applications made late.
Right.
With concern from this.
Correct. And really, what we can say looking back on that is the early applications before we knew we even had it seemed to help with it. And the late ones, once we had it, it was too late. When I listened back to some of our episodes, we talked about it. We were kind of like, well, we already got it. What are we gonna, you know, it was just sort of late in the season to be applying much past brown silk.
That, yeah. Well, and like anything, you know, We were talking just a little bit ago about commodity prices of soybeans, but with corn.
Correct.
The value of corn isn't there. The cost of application, you got to look at that and just decide whether it's worth it. But guys were fearing a total loss if they didn't do anything, and I don't think that would have happened. Even some of the worst fields that I saw myself, it was patchy. I mean, there were spots. Like, you'd go three rows, and it would look like World War III and the whole plant. Oh, my God, it's all going to die. And then you walk a couple more rows, and you're like, oh, no, this is fine. This looks great over here. So
I would agree with that statement, man. There's sizes like the size of, like, a four-wheeler big where they were just hammered. And then you'd go, it wasn't like the rest of it didn't have any, but it had much less. And other diseases like tar spot or northern corn leaf blight, we don't usually see that. I see that with like insect infestations where all of a sudden you'd be like, oh man, like this one plant's just hammered with them. And it was kind of like that.
Seems as though the social media buzz might have been higher than.
Yeah, this one
like,
had
kind of heightened your freak out level.
You had a lot of companies, you know, putting up videos and stuff like how to identify it and all this other stuff. And I mean, we do get common rust, so it's not like we never see rust in corn, but this year it was just, this particular type of rust has the potential to do. And the next time it's here, maybe it will be worse than it was this year. But that's the hard part with, like you said, Todd, something we see every 20 years, kind of forget about it. It's hard to manage because you're not managing it every year. Like tar spot, we know a lot more about because we see it on a more consistent basis. But this is something that, you know, hopefully it'll be another 20 years before we see something this bad. And even that, it wasn't that bad.
It's a good reason that explains why it got number one, Bill. It was this, I didn't think of that, but you're right. It had this social, it had sort of a very much so pandemic feel to it. Of like, we're gonna, if we don't do something, it's gonna be the worst thing ever. And you, when you told people not to treat, it actually felt like you were taking a risk. Like, oh, you know, like, well, are you sure? It's like, yeah, you'll probably be fine. We got to stay the course. Like Matt said, there's an economic thing there that it just didn't pencil out to treat a lot of acres. And in the end, in general, I would say it worked out okay. Obviously, there's, like Matt said, there's places in Iowa that got hammered, so they're going to be a little different. But
all right. Well, that is our top 10 ag stories, but we do have an honorable mention, something that's a little bit closer to home, and that is the UW-Milwaukee research going into turning EV batteries into fertilizers, the potential of reusing materials inside of those electric vehicle batteries to potentially then spread on fields as fertilizer, and that'd be a great way to recycle them. So it's kind of a cool thing that they are looking at moving forward with that. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
This week we talked our top 10 ag stories, going from anywhere from wind, new satellites, to southern rust being the number one story that we talked about this year. And even though it maybe wasn't quite as bad as we thought it was going to be, it's still something that made the news and made a lot of people excited. So thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.